Welcome to Kelly Dry's Full Spectrum Podcast, bringing together thought leaders in the technology, media, and telecommunications industries to discuss legal issues that are expected to impact today's organizations and tomorrow's marketplace. Show notes and additional episodes are available at kellydryfullspectrum.com. For more in-depth commentary, head to our blog at comlawmonitor.com. This podcast is produced by the Kelly Dry Communications Practice Group.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Kelly Dry's Full Spectrum Podcast. I'm Jenny Wainwright, a senior associate in the Communications Practice Group, and I'm joined today by one of our partners in the group, Chip Yorgaitis, and special counsel Mike Dover. On this podcast, we'll be providing summaries of several of the items adopted by the FCC at its most recent open meeting on March 14th, 2024. We'll kick things off with Chip, who will be talking about some of the rules the Commission adopted to create a voluntary cybersecurity labeling program for wireless consumer Internet of Things, or IoT, products. Then you'll hear from Mike, who will discuss new requirements for cable and satellite TV providers to provide, quote, all-in pricing information for their video programming services. Next, I'll be talking about the FCC's findings following its most recent inquiry into whether advanced telecommunications capability, essentially broadband, is being deployed across the country in a reasonable and timely fashion. And then Chip will wrap us up by going over some rules and proposals by the FCC aimed at enhancing network coverage for consumer handsets through better coordination between satellite and terrestrial networks. And with that, Chip, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Jenny, and welcome to everyone that's listening. At its open meeting last week, the FCC adopted a report and order and a further notice of proposed rulemaking in public safety docket number 23239. That report and order establishes a voluntary IoT or Internet of Things labeling program, which is designed to provide consumers with cybersecurity information regarding the wireless IoT products that they use. The FCC moved quickly to a report and order in that docket, as the NPRM was issued only last summer in August. But the report and order reveals that much work remains to be done by the Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau, which will oversee much of the program, and also by the lead administrator, which will be selected from among applicants by the Bureau. Only after all this additional work is done will the labeling program be in full swing. The FCC's action was informed by other government agency actions and significant work of industry and academia. The FCC cited, for example, the May 2021 White House IoT executive order, which emphasized the importance of IoT cybersecurity, and also efforts by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, including the NIST cybersecurity white paper, which details recommended criteria and potential labeling program approaches for the cybersecurity labeling of consumer IoT products. The Commission observed other efforts across the U.S. government, as well as within private industry, and also noted the efforts on the international front with respect to IoT labeling, such as in Singapore and Japan. The FCC defined IoT products as those products that include one or more IoT devices and additional product components necessary to use the IoT device beyond basic operational features. So these IoT products are the focus of this voluntary IoT labeling program. It's limited to wireless consumer products that include intentional radiators. Those that choose to participate must comply with the requirements of the IoT labeling program, including applications, to receive affirmative authority to utilize the FCC IoT label, which bears the Cyber Trust mark. The FCC hopes that this added imprimatur of the Cyber Trust mark will help distinguish products in the marketplace that meet minimum requirements for cybersecurity. The FCC specifically rejected establishing a mandatory IoT labeling program. However, the FCC noted that it did not foreclose the possibility of expanding the IoT labeling program in the future to enterprise or industrial IoT products, to unintentional radiators, or to wireline IoT products. And I want to repeat that the program does not include products that are primarily intended to be used in manufacturing, healthcare, industrial control, or other enterprise applications. Now, the Commission wanted to emphasize in this report and order that the adoption of the voluntary IoT labeling program does not alter equipment authorization requirements under the FCC's rules before products are marketed or operated. Parties are required to follow the Commission's equipment authorization program regardless of whether or not they choose to participate in the IoT labeling program. And they also wanted to make clear there is no requirement to complete the equipment authorization process before qualifying to use the cyber trust mark. But Part 2 rules will continue to prohibit the marketing of an IoT device with an intentional radiator that does not have a valid equipment authorization. The FCC excluded from its IoT labeling program any communications equipment on the cover list that the Commission maintains pursuant to the Secured and Trusted Communications Network Act and equipment produced by certain other entities. There are other products that are excluded, any medical devices that are regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, as well as motor vehicles and motor vehicle equipment, because the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has authority to promulgate regulations on cybersecurity for those types of products. I want to go into a little more detail about the exclusion of products that are on the cover list. The NPRM proposed to exclude from the program not only any equipment on the covered list maintained by the Commission or any IoT device produced by an entity that is identified on the cover list, but it also includes any device or product from a company named on certain other lists maintained by other federal agencies that represent the findings of a national security review. The report and order adopted all of these prohibitions, and the exclusions extend to any additional products produced by an entity identified on the cover list as producing covered equipment. To implement the Commission's goal of ensuring the cyber trust mark is not affixed to products that pose a risk to national security or a risk to public safety, the rules require all applicants seeking authorization to use the FCC IoT label to provide a series of declarations under penalty of perjury. The report and order provides that the Commission will be the program owner and retain ultimate control over the program, although it's delegating a lot of its functions in this regard to the Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau. Now, while the Commission and the Bureau will oversee the program, it will be supported by a number, there's no set number, of cybersecurity label administrators, or CLAs. And from among those CLAs, there will be a lead administrator selected by the Bureau. The CLAs will manage certain aspects of the labeling program. They will be authorized to license the cyber trust mark to manufacturer applicants whose products comply with the Commission's IoT labeling, cybersecurity labeling rules. The lead administrator will be responsible for carrying out additional administrative responsibilities, including but not limited to reviewing applications and recognizing qualified and accredited cybersecurity testing laboratories, which the Commission refers to as cyber labs. And the lead administrator will also engage consumer education regarding the cyber trust mark. The standards and testing procedures developed or identified in collaboration with the CLAs and other stakeholders will be submitted by the lead administrator to the commission, and they will in turn be used by accredited testing labs recognized by the lead administrator, whether the cyber labs, a CLA run lab, or a testing lab internal to a company for product testing. The report and order sets out a series of requirements for any applicant to be a CLA. CLAs must be independent of participants in the program, and each CLA must explain how it will avoid personal and organizational conflict when processing applications. It must provide a description of its processes for evaluating applications for authority to use the FCC IoT label, and the CLA applicant must also demonstrate the expertise necessary to effectively serve as a CLA. Now, if a CLA wants to be considered for the lead administrator position, it must submit a description of how it will execute the duties of the lead administrator, including previous experience in IoT cybersecurity, what role, if any, they have played in IoT labeling in the past, their capacity to execute the responsibilities as lead administrator, and several other criteria. The Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau will issue a public notice opening the filing window to receive applications for the CLA positions. And it's also empowered to open additional filing windows at a subsequent time or otherwise accept additional applications for CLA authority at its discretion. The report and order includes an option for manufacturers to use not only a cyber lab, but also an accredited and lead administrator recognized in-house testing. The CLAs themselves may also have or seek to have their own in-house labs conduct conformity testing for applications in the program. The commission's order makes clear that it will be appropriate to recognize testing labs that have been accredited to ISO IEC 17025 standards to conduct compliance testing rather than to evaluate or accredit a lab pursuant to other criteria. The report and order adopted the NIST core baseline to serve as the basis for the IoT labeling program. The NIST core baseline is found in the September 2022 NIST document, NISTR 8425. NISTR is NISTIR, which is the Institute's profile of the IoT core baseline for consumer IoT products. As the report and order explains, the NIST core baseline is based on product-focused cybersecurity capabilities rather than specific requirements, and this provides flexibility needed due to the diverse marketplace of IoT products, according to the Commission. The NIST core baseline covers the following IoT product capabilities: asset identification, product configuration, data protection, interface access control, software updates, cybersecurity state awareness, and also documentation, information and query reception, information dissemination, and product education and awareness. The last four are categorized into product developer activities. The lead administrator, working with other stakeholders, will identify or develop IoT cybersecurity standards and testing procedures by which to determine if a product seeking to participate in the IoT labeling program meets the NIST 8.14. The framework adopted in the report and order requires all entities seeking to use the FCC IoT label to submit an application for authority to a CLA. The application needs to be supported by an appropriate report detailing the conformity testing conducted by a lab, either a cyber lab, CLA lab, or a manufacturer's in-house lab, as I mentioned earlier. Only entities that have received prior authorization from a CLA are authorized to use the FCC IoT label. This is to ensure that the IoT labeling program retains its integrity. And again, the program is independent of the FCC's equipment authorization requirements. The report and order also establishes a framework for any would-be participant in the voluntary labeling program to seek relief from an adverse action taken by a CLA. The framework requires that any products bearing the FCC IoT label must also include a corresponding QR code. The QR code will link to a decentralized public registry populated with current information on the IoT product in question. A QR code is intended to ensure that if a consumer desires more information about the product beyond what the label itself signifies, that there's a simple means of accessing that information. And the QR code also ensures that information associated with the product's compliance with the IoT labeling program is current. The report and order and the Commission's new rules spell out in detail what information must be provided in the registry. The FCC will require a minimum support period and end date for the support period for IoT products participating in the program. The FCC believes this will provide meaningful information to consumers on the manufacturer's commitment to provide patches or other support. Manufacturers will be able to extend the support period in the registry through a mechanism that will be determined by the lead administrator. The lead administrator will collaborate with stakeholders and provide recommendations to the Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau on how often a given class of IoT products must renew their authority to bear the FCC IoT label. The report and order also provides for audits, post-market surveillance, and enforcement. And the lead administrator will be responsible for developing a consumer education campaign about the FCC's IoT labeling program. Now, there's a further notice that accompanies the report and order. This seeks comment on several issues, for example, whether to require manufacturers to disclose to the commission whether firmware and or software were developed and manufactured in a high-risk country, as well as where firmware and software updates will be developed and deployed from. The further notice also seeks comment on whether to require manufacturers to disclose to consumers in the registry whether firmware and or software were developed and manufactured in a high-risk country. Further notice also inquires whether to require manufacturers to disclose to the commission whether the data collected by the product is stored in or transits a high-risk country or countries, or to require manufacturers to disclose this information to the consumers. And finally, the FNPRM seeks comment whether, if software or firmware originates from high-risk countries, or data will be stored in such countries, or whether products can be remotely controlled by servers within such countries, such products should be ineligible for participating in the IoT label program altogether. While the report and order ostensibly will take effect 30 days after publication in the Federal Register, much of the IoT labeling program will require information collection. So this means that many of the rules must first go through a review by the Office of Management and Budget before they take effect. The comment dates for the further them are 30 and 60 days after Federal Register publication. Mike, I'll now turn to you to discuss the new requirements for cable and satellite TV providers to provide all-in pricing information for their programming services.
Thanks, Chip. On Thursday, a divided commission adopted a report and order requiring, quote, all-in cable and satellite television pricing. But that requires cable operators and direct broadcast satellite, DBS, providers to state the aggregate cost of video programming as a single line item in promotional materials and on subscribers' bills. As background, in June 2023, the Commission released a notice of proposed rulemaking proposing an all-in pricing requirement for cable operators and direct broadcast satellite providers aimed at increasing transparency and avoiding consumer surprise concerning fees charged in addition to advertised rates, and sought comment on how to fit that proposal within the existing federal, state, and local requirements relating to truth in billing, as well as in the current marketplace related to advertising and billing practices for these providers. In the report and order adopted on Thursday, the Commission adopted its NPRM proposal for all-in pricing, concluding that the cable operators and DBS providers must provide an all-in price for video programming as a prominent single line item on both subscriber bills and in promotional materials that otherwise state a price. Let me give you a little bit of background. The report and order briefly summarizes the record in response to the NPRM in comments from proponents to the proposal. The commission noted that individuals, consumer protection organizations, state and local governments, and franchise authorities report, quote, considerable, end quote, consumer confusion and surprise when unanticipated charges and fees for cable and satellite video programming are not included in the advertised price of promotional materials and are listed separately on consumer bills. The commission further pointed to the record showing that approximately 24 to 33% of a consumer's bill is attributable to company-imposed fees, such as broadcast TV fees, regional sports surcharges, HD technology fees, and the like. The commission also found in the record that consumers lack transparent information about fees, and that causes confusion and surprise during the service term, many times resulting in complaints, billing disputes, and litigation. With respect to comments from industry in the record, the commission noted that cable and DBS providers dispute characterizations that their billing and advertising practices are misleading, and pointed to existing Television Viewer Protection Act, or TVPA, billing requirements concerning consumer transparency, and also to marketplace demands which drive accurate and transparent pricing. The commission also noted in the record industry comments that stated that all-in pricing is likely to cause consumer confusion, such as when advertised pricing changes through the inclusion or exclusion of certain channels in a package with different associated fees, and because the all-in pricing proposal would not apply to online video distributors. Ultimately, the commission disagreed with the industry assertions and concluded that the weight of the evidence in the record suggests that the all-in pricing proposal, quote, serves the dual purposes of helping consumers comparison shop among video programming providers when looking at promotional materials and helping subscribers recognize when the price for video service has changed when looking at their bills, end quote. So I'm going to describe a little bit about the all-in rule. As I mentioned, it requires the aggregate cost of video programming as a prominent single line item in promotional materials if the price is included in those promotional materials, and also on subscriber bills. However, if a price is not included in advertisement, the all-in rule does not require cable operators and DBS providers to include a price. So what else is included in the all-in pricing rule? I'll describe a few of them. The report and order goes into more detail, but at a high level, the aggregate all-in price must include any and all amounts that the cable operator or DBS provider charges a consumer for video programming, including for broadcast retransmission consent, regional sports programming, and other programming-related fees. But charges unrelated to providing the video programming, such as for taxes, administrative fees, and equipment fees, are excluded from the all-in price. And in addition to the all-in price, cable operators and DBS providers may complement the aggregate all-in price with an itemized list of explanations of the component parts that make up the all-in price. The report and order goes into detail as to several specific circumstances. I'm going to address a few of them here. I'll refer you to the report and order for more detail or additional circumstances. But with respect to bundled services, meaning where the cable operator and DBS provider bundles video programming with other services like broadband internet service, the commission concluded that if a cable operator or a DBS provider charges or will charge for a cost related to video programming in whole or in part, then disclosure of those costs must comply with the all-in rule. And if a discount is applied as part of a bundle, the discount also must be presented in clear, easy to understand terms and must include the promotion discount timeframe or the date on which the price will change for the video programming portion. With respect to grandfathered service plans, the commission finds that the all-in rule applies, stating, quote, "We are persuaded that consumers of legacy plans benefit as much as consumers of available plans, and that the benefits of providing an all-in price outweigh the burdens described by the industry," end quote. In promotional discounts, the commission found that if a discount is applied, it also must be presented in clear, easy to understand terms, which includes an expiration date, if applicable, and if a provider offers an introductory all-in discounted rate as part of promotional materials, it must also state the all-in rate that applies following the introductory period, and that or the time schedule of the price increase. Lastly, with respect to regional and national promotional material, which may reflect different fees such as regional sports fees, the commission concluded that cable operators and DBS providers must advertise a range of all-in pricing when reaching out to general audiences, such as national audiences, with the range to include the all-in price that is the highest for that audience. With respect to existing state, local, and federal laws and regulations and other consumer protection, local consumer protection statutes, the commission concluded that it shares, quote, "bifurcated authority," end quote, with state and local governments, but concludes that the all-in rules sets baseline consumer requirements at the federal level. And the commission states that states and local governments may tailor more specific consumer service regulations based on their community needs, based on that baseline. For the effective date, the commission stated that the all-in rule must be fully implemented within 9 months of release of the order and report, or after the Office of Management and Budget completes review of any information collection requirements required by the Paperwork Reduction Act, whichever is later. Lastly, I'll note that the report and order extensively discuss the commission's legal authority to adopt the all-in rules I've described here, pointing to the TVPA, Section 632 of the Act for cable operators, and Section 335 for DBS providers, among others. In comments from the bench, Commissioner Carr dissented from the report and order, stating that these statutes only afford the commission authority to implement the all-in rule as to cable billing and not as to cable advertising and DBS billing and advertising. Commissioner Symington also dissented on the same grounds and expressly questioned the commission's authority to impose the all-in rule for the benefit of non-subscribers. Commissioner Symington also pointedly said that the commission has little hope of prevailing on its authority in these areas over advertising requirements if challenged. The commission adopted the report and order on a divided basis with a vote of 3-2. Now I'll turn it over to Jenny, who's going to address the commission's actions with regard to the Section 706 report. Jenny?
Thanks, Mike. So I'll be talking today about the other controversial item on the FCC's agenda, the Section 706 report, which was also adopted with a 3-2 vote of the commissioners. By way of background, Section 706 of the Communications Act requires the FCC to conduct an annual inquiry concerning the availability of advanced telecommunications capability to all Americans, including in particular elementary and secondary schools and classrooms, as part of an effort to determine whether advanced telecommunications capability is being deployed to Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion. If the answer is no, Section 706 directs the Commission to take immediate action to accelerate deployment of such capability by removing barriers to infrastructure investment and by promoting competition in the telecommunications market. For more than 20 years, the FCC has conducted inquiries and issued reports based on this statutory mandate, but there are a few things that make this report particularly interesting and, like I said a minute ago, controversial. For one thing, it changed the speed benchmark for fixed broadband. Since 2015, the FCC had used a 25.3 standard for these inquiries, meaning that it was assessing the state of broadband deployment with service speeds at 25 megabits per second downstream and 3 megabits per second upstream. In this report, the commission changed that speed benchmark for fixed broadband to a 120 standard, or 100 megabits per second downstream and 20 upstream. It also adopted a long-term goal of 1 gigabit per second downstream and 500 megabits per second upstream. The FCC explained that it was adopting this new benchmark to meet market realities that most consumers expect and need a faster connection than 25.3. It also noted that numerous federal broadband grant programs, including the BEAD program, require minimum speeds of 120 to qualify for funding. Another novel component of the report was the source of the data. This is the first Section 706 report that the FCC has issued based on its broadband data collection process. Historically, the commission issued its findings based on what entities reported on what was known as Form 477. However, this form was sunset in 2022, and providers must now report to the FCC through the broadband data collection process. The FCC explained that this process provides insight into broadband service availability with much greater detail than the Form 477 process. Having established the speed benchmark, and according to the report, with respect to fixed broadband as of 2022, overall, fixed broadband has not been physically deployed to approximately 7% of Americans. For people living in rural areas and tribal lands, approximately 28% and 23% of them, respectively, do not have access to fixed broadband services. With respect to mobile broadband, the commission declined to set a speed benchmark, but noted that its analysis regarding service availability was based on a single threshold for speed of 5G NR of 35.3 megabits per second, which is the highest speed that the commission collects in the broadband data collection for mobile broadband. Here again, the commission was relying on information reported through the broadband data collection process and found that at year-end 2022, approximately 91% of Americans lived in areas with that speed threshold coverage, including approximately 64% of the population in rural areas and 78% of the population in tribal areas. Finally, with respect to broadband availability in schools, the commission adopted a new speed benchmark of 1 gigabit per second per 1,000 students and staff, and reported that 74% of school districts currently meet this goal. Beyond physical deployment, the report also included discussion of other factors that the commission deemed relevant to the question of availability. These included affordability, adoption rates, service quality, and reliability. The commission noted that it lacked comprehensive data on these issues, but indicated its interest in revisiting them in the future to inform FCC policy going forward. The report also included an extensive discussion of the various FCC initiatives and policies undertaken to promote universal service. And at the end of all of that, the commission reported its conclusion that, quote, advanced telecommunications capability is not being deployed to all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion. Now, as I noted at the outset, this report was not approved unanimously. Commissioners Carr and Symington both voted against it. In his dissenting statement, Commissioner Carr suggested that, quote, the Section 706 inquiry is no longer about assessing the pace of broadband builds, end quote, and that the real purpose behind the failing grade in the report was to tee up Title II internet regulation. He further criticized the data used to issue the report, claiming that it was outdated and that it was not technologically neutral because it excluded satellite services. Commissioner Symington echoed some of these points in his dissent and further noted his concern with the long-term gigabit speed target. He commented that the commission needs, quote, to be able to articulate the use cases for such high speeds, end quote, before using it to develop universal service objectives and programs. And now back over to Chip for the last item that we'll be covering today.
Thank you, Jenny. Now I'll turn to the fourth item from the commission's open meeting that we are covering today. The commission took action in dockets 2365 and 22271 to foster collaborations between satellite operators and terrestrial service providers to offer ubiquitous connectivity directly to consumer handsets using spectrum that previously was allocated only to terrestrial services. The commission labels these types of operations as supplemental coverage from space, or SCS. In the report and order, and further notice of proposed rulemaking adopted by the commission sought to balance its desire to accelerate SCS operations with the need to retain the service quality of terrestrial networks, to protect spectrum usage rights, and to minimize the risk of harmful interference to both federal and non-federal non-SCS users, both domestic and cross-border, and in both co-band and adjacent band spectrum. The FCC emphasized throughout the report and order the goal of minimizing the risk of harmful interference. The FCC emphasized that its report and order represents an initial step to encourage the development of SCS. The agency stated its intention that as the marketplace for SCS develops, to build on the new framework and enable deployment of SCS in additional bands and scenarios. To implement the new framework, the commission adopted rules that modify the U.S. table of frequency allocations to authorize in a specific initial set of bands, bidirectional secondary bases, mobile satellite service or MSS operations, where the spectrum has no primary, non-flexible use legacy incumbents, federal or non-federal. In these initial SCS bands, the new rules authorize SCS only where there is one or more terrestrial licensees, which together hold all the licenses on the relevant channels throughout the geographically independent area. Those licensees must lease access to their spectrum rights to a participating satellite operator, whose Part 25 license reflects the frequencies and the GIA, the geographically independent area, in which they will offer SES. Conversely, if a single licensee holds all licenses on the frequencies within the GIA, then it can enter into a relationship with multiple satellite operators with which it has spectrum leases to provide SES. The new framework does not permit SES where there are multiple terrestrial licensees and multiple satellite operators within the frequencies in the relevant GIA. Moreover, SES opportunities will be limited to spectrum allocated and licensed to terrestrial licensees. The new SES rules do not apply to any satellite spectrum bands in which space station operators may wish to partner and provide access to their spectrum to terrestrial licensees. The initial list of SES bands are as follows. In the 600 megahertz range, from 614 to 652 megahertz, and 663 to 698 megahertz. In the 700 megahertz range, from 698 to 769 megahertz, 775 to 799 megahertz, and 805 to 806 megahertz. This 700 megahertz range includes the public safety spectrum that's licensed to FirstNet. The FCC included it because it concluded there were compelling public safety benefits to make this spectrum potentially available for SES. The third range for SES in the report and order is 800 megahertz, from 824 to 849 megahertz and 869 to 894 megahertz. Also included are broadband PCS frequencies from 1850 to 1915 megahertz and 1930 to 1995 megahertz. And finally, the AWSH block from 1915 to 1920 megahertz and 1995 to 2000 megahertz is included. Satellites in non-geostationary orbits and those in geostationary satellite orbits, respectively NGSOs and GSOs, may be eligible to enter into a relationship with terrestrial licensees and provide SES. To provide SES, this will require a Part 25 authorization. The satellite operator must have a valid lease arrangement that covers all frequencies over which it provides SES and within the entire area of a GIA. The FCC specifically declined to allow spectrum sharing for SES at this time, but noted that terrestrial licensees' control of their networks means dynamic spectrum sharing may be an option that the terrestrial licensees consider to enable these operations. Importantly, the SES framework adopted in the report and order explicitly does not foreclose the ability for parties with proposals for providing SES that do not satisfy the framework adopted in the report and order from applying to the commission and demonstrating that they will not cause harmful interference under proposed parameters specific to their proposed SES operations. The FCC made clear that it will continue to consider on a case-by-case basis filings for waivers or special temporary authority made by interested parties seeking to provide SES operations on terrestrial frequencies. So that includes proposals to operate in bands other than the initial SES bands. The commission moved quickly to a decision in this proceeding. On March 17th, 2023, almost exactly 1 year before last week's open meeting, the FCC released the notice of proposed rulemaking, seeking comment on a proposed SES regulatory framework. The FCC was not starting from scratch. For a number of years, the FCC had already facilitated satellite and terrestrial SES-like partnerships that promised to deliver connectivity over terrestrial spectrum by granting experimental authorizations, other limited authorizations, and ad hoc rule waivers. Under this new framework, would-be SES operators must file applications to the FCC under Part 25. Applicants can be existing space station licensees in another band, or they can be first-time space station applicants. Each SES proposal will be reviewed by the FCC's entry criteria. Any applicable rules and requirements will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis for each application. The agency emphasized that just because a band is available for SES operations does not guarantee that the commission will automatically authorize an SES collaboration between a satellite operator and terrestrial operator in the requested spectrum band. The FCC will require satellite operators and terrestrial licensee partners to have a Part 1 lease arrangement or agreement on file with the commission so that the relevant universal licensing system file numbers can be included in the SES Part 25 application. The commission determined that the lease or agreements must be granted or accepted before the commission issues the Part 25 license or modification of an existing license to deploy and operate satellites that will provide them. Likewise, satellite operators desiring to provide SES services must ensure that the Part 1 lease remains valid for the entire period the satellite operator provides SES. The Commission found that because the SES framework contemplates a relationship between a satellite operator and a terrestrial licensee to jointly operate in the band for which the terrestrial licensee holds an exclusive license, there's no need for a processing round for NGSO SES operators. Because given the terrestrial licensee's rights, no mutually exclusive applicants can seek to share the spectrum for SES. GSO operators applying under the SES framework will be exempt from the normally applicable first-come, first-served rules that apply to GSO operators. The Commission, with its report and order, moved ahead of the international community on SES policy, claiming that international regulators are looking to the United States and the FCC for leadership on how to address novel SES services. At the recently ended World Radio Communications Conference 2023 in Dubai, the ITU member administrations adopted an agenda item for World Radio Conference 2027 to study several candidate spectrum bands already allocated to the mobile service and identified for terrestrial international mobile telecommunications, or IMT, to assess whether the bands can be used for SES-like operations. The ITU terminology for SES is direct-to-device communications. The FCC's report and order makes clear that SES operations will be secondary and they will be fully subject to the U.S. international obligations under treaties, bilateral or multilateral agreements, the ITU regulations, and other instruments of the ITU. So any future SES operations authorized by the FCC may not cause harmful interference to other countries' operations that conform to the ITU radio regulations. Under the SES framework, as part of an application for a Part 25 authorization, SES applicants seeking to use spectrum on a non-conforming basis with respect to the international table of frequency allocations will be required to provide detailed interference analyses and associated link budgets showing that the requested operations will not cause harmful interference to stations operating in accordance with the ITU radio regulations. In identifying the initial SCS bands, the commission rejected inclusion of several other frequency ranges that were under consideration. And these include several allocations between 1390 and 1435 megahertz, band 1670 to 1675 megahertz, the band 1695 to 1710 megahertz, AT&T WCS spectrum in the 2.3 gigahertz band, as well as the range of spectrum between 2496 and 2690 megahertz. A few other points of interest before I say a few words about the further notice. The FCC will not allow licensees to rely on the service provided by their satellite operator partners and lessees for the purpose of satisfying terrestrial licensee construction and performance requirements. In addition, the primary responsibility for an SCS operator's compliance with the non-interference obligations of its secondary operations depends upon the type of lease it has with the terrestrial licensee. With a spectrum manager lease, it is the terrestrial licensee that will have primary responsibility to resolve all interference disputes that may arise. Whereas under a de facto transfer lease, the lessee, meaning the SCS operator, will have primary responsibility for ensuring compliance with the interference protection rules, although the terrestrial licensee will also have responsibility in a secondary capacity. In addition, the terrestrial licensees that participate in an SCS arrangement must continue to hold the underlying spectrum right throughout the relevant GIA and frequencies as described in the satellite operator's Part 25 authorization or the SCS authorization to remain valid. And then finally, I'll mention that over the objections of SpaceX and T-Mobile, who have partnered on SCS-like operations granted prior to the report and order, the FCC adopted an aggregate out-of-band interference limit applicable to space station operations in the initial SCS bands. As for the further notice to proposed rulemaking, the FCC is seeking comment on improvements to the 911 rules that will apply to terrestrial providers when using SCS to extend their coverage. The FCC in the interim will apply a framework of 911 call and text routing requirements to SCS operations while working toward a resolution of the further notice of proposed rulemaking. Another primary aspect of the further notice has to do with the protection of radio astronomy. The FCC seeks comment on whether the unique nature of SCS may warrant additional consideration related to the protection of radio astronomy. The report and order takes effect in 30 days, but many of the rules involve information collection and will require review by the Office of Management and Budget. There will be a further notice from the Space Bureau and the Wireless Telecommunications Bureau setting the effective date of the rules undergoing OMB review. Comments on the further notice will be due 30 days after Federal Register publication, and reply comments will be due 60 days after Federal Register publication. And unlike some of the earlier items covered by Jenny and Mike, the SCS report and order and the cyber security label report and order were adopted unanimously with no dissents. We thank you for joining our Full Spectrum podcast today. The next open meeting is April 25th, and we will be back to you with another podcast following that meeting. The tentative agenda for that meeting is expected to be identified by the chairwoman's office on April 4th. Take care. Until next time.
The views and ideas expressed on this program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kelly Dry & Warren, LLP, its staff, or management.